Hello, I'm David Newell, but you might know me as the speedy delivery man, Mr. McFeely, on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and you're listening to a podcast where nostalgia comes alive. It's Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show. Speedy delivery to you. Oh, I mean, roll it.
Welcome to Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show, the podcast where nostalgia comes alive. Since July of 2021, Jake and his friends have interviewed professionals in the worlds of acting, directing, writing, puppeteering, and many more. Who will they be chatting with in this week's interview? Find out in this Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show episode.
Hello everyone, welcome to this episode of Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show, where nostalgia comes alive. Happy here with us, thank you for joining. Of course, as always, I'm your host, Jake Duffenball. Me today, of course, our co-hosts, Chris Bixby and Matt Bingle. How you guys doing?
Doing good.
Doing good. Hi, everybody. How are you, Jake?
I'm doing great, Matt. Thank you for asking. Chris, good. What do we have for today?
Yeah, it's happy you're here with us, folks. Today's guest is a director, writer, and producer. He directed and wrote for the long-running PBS series Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and is an executive producer on the PBS cooking show Ciao Italia. He also wrote and directed projects for Disney and a lot more that we'll be discussing throughout our chat. Please welcome Paul Alley. Paul, happy to have you here.
My pleasure. Pleasure. Glad to be here.
Wonderful to hear.
Yes.
It means a lot.
Pleasure is ours. So could you tell our audience a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Well, I don't know what else I would have done. For a living, I cooked French fries at McDonald's. I dug ditches for a plumbing company. I got drafted in the Army during Vietnam. And when I got out, I used to listen to Barbra Streisand records, if you remember her. And this is before music videos. I'm an old geezer. So I would imagine I would see, you know, like music videos in my head. And when I got out, I got on the GI Bill, went to University of Maryland. And I remember standing at the end of the hallway, and to the right was radio and television film department. To the left was theater. Both my brothers were theater majors and opera singers and stuff. But I thought about Barbara, and I hung a hard right and went down and got into a radio and television program and film at University of Maryland. And I just have spent a life in public television. 10 years earning my stripes, and then my big break came with Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, working with Fred Rogers for 10 years. I was a writer for the program, and I was the television director. So I'm in the studio trying to figure out where to put Henrietta Pussycat and how to do X the Owl, King Friday, and on location with Fred, you know, doing how people make balloons, how people make bicycle helmets. Million things. But that was my big break, and I loved it. 10 years of that. And then I moved on to new, I thought I was ready to teach broadcasting. I got my master's degree, and I thought, okay, this is it. Have my big break. I'm done. Now I'm going to teach, you know. So I ended up in University of New Hampshire at public television there. And within a year, I taught some television and film production, but and I worked at a public television station and took over Ciao Italia with Marianne Esposito. It was her first step into national television, and it had been local for 2 years, regional. And since I had Fred's experience with Mr. Rogers, I took over. And 30 years later, and I don't know, 400 shows later, 3,000 recipes later, it's the longest running cooking show in America. And working with Marianne Esposito is, she's as nutty as Fred Rogers was. I mean, these people can connect with that lens. They can look in and they make that connection. So I don't know if that was too involved or too brief, but, and here I am in Winslow, Arizona, the old song Standing on the Corner, Winslow, Arizona. I grew up here as a kid, left 1,000 years ago, moved back 5 years ago. Because of technology, et cetera, I can work here. Mm-hmm. And that's great. So that's my story. And on the, that's TV. And I'm writing my 14th novel. So have a life, and I'm happy. And I really am a writer. And I'm right in the middle of my third book in the trilogy.
Oh, nice.
Flyboy. Wow. So that's nice. It. Now, God, I hope I'm sounding like a gas bag. So I'm monitoring myself. So anyway, that's it.
No worries.
And you thought Hugh Martin was nuts. Well, Hugh was like,
no, Hugh, he's absolutely nuts.
Yeah,
he is. Yes. Especially his, you know, his energy, and it's like, hi, it's good to see you. Such a wonderful man.
He's such a delight. Yeah, love him.
That's who he is.
Delight.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Pretty
he's
much.
Done a lot of work with kids TV too. Aside from Mr. Rogers, directed a whole bunch of shows.
Hugh directed, wrote, he directed and produced, directed and edited. He was a real one man band. When I showed up, they divided the labor into directing, to producing, and I did the directing, and I supervised editing and writing. Hugh didn't do writing, but I did. Because they hired me to do that, Fred did, because they wanted to do some adult programming. So I did a couple screenplays that were produced for the American Playhouse, things like that. And then, so, it was great. I still, you know, here I am, you know. I know what it's like to dig a plumbing ditch, okay? I know what it's like to get blisters on my hands. And the thing that drove me the most was that I don't know what it's like to do. I mean, I'm not binary. I'm not like either or, zeros and one. I'm a creative artist, geek ads. I don't even want to say that, but hey, I am. And so I'm so grateful I was able to make a living, and I still am. And you know, I think for my case, and I've obviously mentored a lot of young people coming up in the business. And I echo Woody Allen's quote. He says 99% of success is showing up, you know, just being there.
Exactly.
And have a fire inside of you, you know, that you know, I just couldn't help it. And I just had to keep doing it and, you know, raise a family. And made it so.
Nice.
Very nice. So what made you want to get into directing and writing?
Well, directing, I started off as a floor director on a news show, and I mean as a camera operator, and then a floor director, you move up the ladder. In the end, I felt that I did a lot. The reason I studied, a good example, when I was in college and GI Bill, all of my fellow television people were taking a business course as a minor. I took sociology because I figured mass media deals with a lot of people. So I'm going to learn, I want to get a hunch for that, a feel for people. And that's, I think, has always been my calling, and that I've worked with people who do definitely do that. They look into the lens. And Marianne says, you know, you saute these sausages till then. Fred Rogers would say, there's nobody in the world exactly like you. People can like you just to... so they can make that connection in that little piece of glass. And I did a lot of that. I did a fairy tale series, Tell a Tales, Gather Around. And I was the host because I thought, Christ, I got to find somebody. And I couldn't find anybody to do the setup, you know, for the illustrations.
Mm-hmm.
So I went in there. We filmed the very first day. I came back in the editing room, sat down. Back then, you have film. You laced it up on this Steinbeck editor. And I was all alone. I closed the door and I said, well, here goes. And there I am. Said, you know, when I was a little boy, I always wanted to, and I'm just doing a setup. And I'm there going, wow, that's him, you know, not me. I buy it. I'm so relieved because it meant that I knew what it took to have like you get sort of split your brain off. Even while I'm talking now, I'm looking at a lens. I have a little monitor camera at the center of the screen. So when I'm talking to you guys, I'm looking into that glass. I'm not. Okay. And see the difference? Now watch.
Right. Yeah.
That's it. We're all monkeys. We're all bozos on this bus, and we all respond to that. And You know, I do it as like a professional mind thing. Marianne, no, Fred Rogers, they just who they are. They didn't give a damn. My rule was take away the camera. Will they still do that on the street to somebody? Yeah. Okay. It's just who they are.
Yeah.
So I had to learn as a director to basically leave them the hell alone. Set the scene, keep it, you know, give them the environment where it's all them. Once that camera's rolling or film's rolling or the video's rolling, that, and Fred was a master at it, so was Marianne. But they didn't think it through like I'm doing it right now with you guys, because you're like, you're media wired. Their communication wired. You know, they want to get something
right
out.
Yes,
you know, they want to do that, and yeah, they're excited about it. They can't help it. You know, stop me before I cook again, or stop me before I whatever. It's just so I've always felt I'm obviously answering very long, but rather than me saying I don't know, I just liked it, you know, I'm not stiffing you on the answer. So but I really got into mass communication and studied it and felt that, so I brought that to a TV studio where I was just this lowly part-time camera operator. But in my mind, I wanted to be the boss. I mean, it sounds lame, but when I was in the Army, I was just I was a sergeant. I got up to a sergeant. And I could just, you know, I feel like I can handle something like that. And I wanted to do it. I mean, I've worked with terrific camera operators, terrific team, all these people. But in the end, I'm wearing a hat today, but and I'm not, you know, anyhow, but it's there. Here's the deal. In a TV studio, there's 1,000 lights, and God's bright shit. It's just terrible. So my thought was that film comes in, and there's a lot of people doing stuff. So someone walks in and said, you know, who's in charge? What's going on here? Who's it? Whatever it is. Who's the guy or who's the woman? And they would go, that guy over there in the hat. Boom. And the bill kept the lights out of my eyes, but it also meant I was other people had hats, but it's that guy with the hat. So. And I like that feeling. Here's the rule. I have 2 grown daughters now. I have a couple, 5 grandkids. Sarah, my youngest one, when she was just a teeny baby, maybe 3 months old, 4 months old. Now make it about 5, big enough to be happy and stuff, but I'm walking. I would get her and I'd throw her up there and catch her. Throw her, and I'd watch her face and she's going up, whoa. I mean, she was not frightened. She was thrilled. Huh? And down she came. And I would do it all the time. And when my mother would ever stop to visit, she would like have a heart attack. Like, my God, you know, seeing me, I mean, I'm throwing that kid up maybe 4 feet. And they're like this. And I did it with Gabriel, too, mother daughter. And I still remember I said, Mom, it's so simple. There's one rule, you don't drop the baby.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't. That's there's no excuse. There's no you. And no matter what happens, you don't drop the baby. So I've kept that phrase in my work ethic for years. Fred Rogers used to use it, or he would say, but didn't I said, we can't drop the baby on this, right? Got it. And the same thing with Marianne Esposito. Can't, you know, don't, we can't drop. We don't know if we should do this. I said, it's going to be wonderful because we can't drop the baby. And I'm sorry, but there are no dead kids and I never dropped a baby. And Marianne and Fred Rogers never screwed up. It works, okay? But it's a tough rule. So, mm-hmm. And it works. So don't drop the baby.
So do you remember your first like kind of professional jobs as a director and writer?
Sure. I mean, with when I worked for Children's Television International after my working in public television as a camera operator, and I got into a job with them and I produced, directed, and wrote short films. These are like 15 minutes for in-school programming. They don't probably do that much nowadays, but back then they'd wheel in the TV and the students would sit and watch a 15-minute program. The teacher would have a syllabus to go along with it, blah, blah. I did a couple series that way, and I learned to write. excuse me, and direct and do everything. And it was on film. And I think I edited it too. So I couldn't drop the baby, see? And it was my big break. I just worked my ass off. This was before Fred. So I really got into being the boss, okay? Mm-hmm. And when I got to Mr. Rogers, within about a month, I realized, oh, I'm not the boss, the producer. I'm the director and I'm the writer. And deep down, I went, shit, that's not what I want. But I love Fred Rogers. And it's like, you know, one of the apostles saying, I don't know, I'm not cool about this, Jesus. I'm out of here. So I had this conflict of ethics and philosophies. And I stayed because I really love Fred and I love what we were doing. And it was a big ass, you know, national show.
And oh, yes.
So it all balanced off. But deep down, I kept saying, you know, I don't want to drop. I want to be the one not to drop the baby. So in varying degrees, you can as a director or editor, or writer, lighting director, props, stuff like the properties, you know, in my case, I just needed that. So, and it's just my particular sense of, and not necessarily competence. I'm not a jerk, you know, like, oh, I can, no, I'm just me, but I have had too many occasions where something has worked. The team has got together. You know, I have a 25-person crew when we film or we tape Marianne's show in a studio. That's a lot of people. And everybody knows that they can say anything about something's going on. And a lot of times, this is a secret, they'll say, I don't know if you want to move over to whatever the suggestion is. Even though I was going to do that, I go, let's do it. So what I'm saying is that, you know, I don't own this thing. And they'll remember that I took their idea. B, it's their turn not to drop the baby. So they go, you know, it's that sense of unifying. And you, what you get is a family and all these cliches. But in the end, you know, all of us are just a simple family. I don't care. I'm talking, you know, in a podcast and I'm in Winslow, Arizona, that I'm able to go up and down the scale of philosophy and way of living and things like that, that I kind of use that in my daily life. So I had PT this morning. I have a bump shoulder, hurt it. So everybody there, I mean, they're just, I'm in the same, you know, we're on the same boat. We're all bozos on the same bus. And I'm that kind of person. And I have worked in a mass communication business that lets me do that. And I'm very grateful. And I still am. Who, here's the last. I'm worse than Hugh Martin. He's going to kill me. I'm getting all jacked up. But here's the deal. Okay. People need, this is the simplest thing. People want to love and be loved. Everything, and I mean everything else, is interesting commentary, but it's commentary. So who's not going to not want to be feel love? Okay?
Exactly.
Boom it in on anybody. And it helps that I'm 6'4" and I'm effusive, but I'm a nice guy. Yeah. And Hugh Martin, same way. People just respond. I like it when people are that way with me. So people want to love and be loved. Remember that. And that's it. Everything else, go for it. But do that and, you know, and I'm glad I'm not 25, you know, in the middle of, you know, this trying to stay alive in the business and being with all kinds of different kind of people. And, you know, there's a lot of assholes out there. God bless them. God bless them. You know, they just are. And doesn't mean you can be one. It's
right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Keep going. I'm just,
exactly.
I'm Mr. Gasbag. This is what you get from me being an hour later. I wasn't ready for this, but
that's okay.
It's fine.
No worries at all. So now, since you kind of touched base in a little bit, you know, working with, you know, Fred for, you know, from his special neighborhood. Now, I'm kind of curious. How did you kind of first begin working on that show?
I answered an ad in Broadcasting Magazine. The company I was with, the Children's Television International, had gone belly up. I was working like kind of categorizing film and shit, but I was thinking, how am I going to raise two kids and a family? And I'm going to go in and doing ads and stuff. So I started bidding on stuff, and I saw an ad in Broadcasting Magazine. It said wanted. I didn't even see that. Just you look in the ads in the back. It said television director for children's programming, box K7. That was it. So I sent out the resume, and I sent out a writing sample of a screenplay I was working on, and just moved on in my day. Got a call, and they wanted to talk to me, and I knew it was Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. I mean, I landed there, I met with them, and here's the best part. I didn't have anything to lose. Are you kidding? You think I'm jacked up now? I was like, who cares? Who fucking cares? I'm just, I'm me. I love you. That's I wasn't. And what Fred really hired me because of my writing, number one, I had sent up a sample from the screenplay called Iron Annie. And it happens to be a little eulogy set over the grave of these soldiers that died. This actually happened in World War II. All these young men from a certain town enlisted together, went off to war, torpedo hit them. This is World War II. Sank, everybody's dead. So all the young men in this small town, gone, boom.
Wow.
And they went into the bottom of the ocean. So I'm recreating a similar echo of that. And these two Walter Matthau, Jack Lemmon, kind of older pilot characters. He does a eulogy about the boys. Okay. And that's what Fred liked. And Fred saw something there. And because I just, and just kept going. But that was my hook. I remember I got home. And, they didn't say I had the job, but I think 2 days later, the phone call rang, and King, I picked it up and said hello, and said, this is King Friday. I was wishing to speak with your daughter, Sarah, if she is available. And Sarah was, I think, 9 years old by then. And I said, it's King Friday. So I just, and they talked for a while. She cared about me. Then she was done and handed it back. So that was how basically I got the job. So, and I had, when I arrived there, it's true for anything, but mostly I remember reading this, when a pastor goes to a new church, Fred incidentally is an ordained Presbyterian minister, but his ministry was television. That was his church. He thought he was going to go to church once he got his thing, but he said, no, you stay there. And when a new minister comes into town, he goes into a honeymoon. He had got 90 days to get all his changes, because then pretty soon everything starts closing in. The old ways come in, blah, blah, blah. But he's got 90 days. So when I'm in that very first meeting with Hugh Martin, the original show, you see the model of the neighborhood. You go into the house, you dissolve to the interior. Fred goes through the door. It's a beautiful day. Okay, like that. That's the standard open. When Hugh was there, Hugh was very visual, very gifted. He said, I'm going to have that dude walk down the side street, then go up the steps, and then go in the door. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, and it works, but I kept watching that saying, what? First of all, I said, I think it was after I got the job. Yeah, because I knew I was in my new minister in town honeymoon. I went, okay, what we're going to do, Fred, I didn't say, do you mind? I said, here's what we're going to do. And we do our standard zoom into the house. And when we dissolve, I want you coming through that door. I don't want you walking sideways because it's like this. You're not doing this, okay? And I keep thinking, Fred's whole gig, his whole gig is this. Okay? So, and I remember, and I said, we'll just do two cameras most of the time, not three in the studio, just two. And I can just see him. He's liking this new minister, because that's all he wanted. He wanted to see that kind of investment in what he did. And he was pretty good. He'd tell you what he wanted to do, and then you'd go do it. He did not fuss or interfere, never. He was just, you know, you were on your own. You had, that baby was always yours not to draw. So I took away that move of Hughes and made those kind of changes. The only thing I would want to mention with, because our primary audience is a preschooler, you know, 3 to 5, you know, it's not. We had flying to California one time to film out there. I think it was almost the whole swim team of UCLA was flying home, you know, on a charter, not a charter flight, but they're all on a plane. These are college kids, and halfway through the flight, somebody spots Fred. So all these big guys walk, it's a beautiful dude. They all get up, walk down, and sing to Fred, you know, so he's just taking it all in. So, which is proof that a lot of college students watch the show, a lot of adults, you know, it's just because the power, excuse me, of my original thesis that people want to love and be loved. And if Fred doesn't love you, who does, you know? And college students, you know, stress and strain of life, older folks, things like that, would watch Fred, you know, and no one else is looking. So you just kind of, you know, get that Fred buzz, because he was good at it, you know. So, and that's how I got my big start in there, making changes. And I also knew that a 3 or 4 year old, you and I, when we watch a film or a movie, we'll see a group shot, and then we cut, you know, over the shoulder shot, a close up. And you follow the logic. A 3-year-old or 4-year-old watching that, when the shot goes from a wide shot, or if it's a wide shot and then a close up, they go, "Where the hell am I now? What's?" There's no film grammar established. It gets finished pretty soon. But when I took over, I thought 2 cameras. There's only going to be 2 choices. And if it's a wide shot, we'll dolly in. I'll go to an over the shoulder. Then I'll go to a close up. Then I'll come back, I'll walk in, walk out. Nobody will give it. I think one person knew that, a friend of mine, Arthur Greenberg, who since passed away. He saw what I was up to. Nobody else figured, you know, why would they care? But he saw the logic of directing that way, trying to make it. And I was teaching, sounds pompous, but I was teaching film grammar to a preschooler. So, you know, they were watching, and we did... You know, Sesame Street was what they call cognitive learning. We did inductive. Yeah, I think inductive, which is feelings. Cognitive is ABC, 1, 2, 3, color blue, color red. And I don't think it's inductive. But see, the other one is, you know, I feel like I'm sad today. What happened? And these are emotional components. We empathic. We taught that. And I figured, well, I'll give you one example. Betty Aberlin talking to XAL, Daniel Striper, Tiger, at the clock. Okay.
Yeah.
I directed that when I would get the scripts in advance, whether I wrote them or mostly Fred wrote them, but I'd have to break the scripts down and kind of have cameras move, you know, what am I going to do? Block it in my mind. And I learned with Betty through Fred that they would have a dialogue back and forth, 2 shots, she at the clock. Close up of Betty, close up of Daniel. But whenever Daniel had something important to say, I didn't have a close up of Daniel going, boom, boom, boom. The hell? He's a rag puppet. Fred knew that. He's got fish line for whiskers. When Daniel had an important line to say, it was always a 2-shot. And it was Betty's reaction to what he said. And that sold it. I would stand there during playback. We'd always look at playback with scenes and stuff. And I'd watch, I'd stand next to Fred. We'd watch. I don't think I have any picture of it. But then I'm kind of aside of my eye. We'd watch people watching the scene. Because you would watch everything you did in a segment, prove it or redo it. We almost never redid.
Right.
But you would, you know, Fred was signing off on stuff. And I would watch other people watching. You know, and they were engaged with it. And I said, this is, and I've learned that with Betty, and that any kind of a lot other directing, they'd have, you know, XAL or Lady Aberlin at the museum go round, and the people were always how'd they do it? They were kind of standing like this and the puppets here, and they're kind of go, so anyhow, you know, I'm going to do this. And that. And they, I don't think you talk to people that way, right? Unless you're in a firing squad, you're both going to die. Otherwise, you know, you look at them. So I would arrange the blocking. So I would have an over the shoulder shot just for Betty, you know, talking to Daniel. You know, I would work it that way. So it's those kind of behind the scenes stuff that really don't matter unless, you know, unless right. you ask. So I told you. So that's what I did.
Absolutely. So, neighborhood of make believe. It's so, I think that was a great like segment to have for the series, you know. And then the kids, you know, who are actually watching it, kind of, you know, if Daniel or you know any of the characters felt the same way, you know, the kids will react the same way. Like what happens if their parents, you know, thought that they're going away or those type of stories like that.
I think
that was great for them to have
something that kids can relate to.
Very important
in children's shows. You always want to, you know, have something that kids can relate to.
Oh yeah.
Fred leaving, he always say, "I'll be back when the week is new," and he would come in. I mean, giving you stuff, you probably know it, but if not, you know, he came in. There's a reason he took off his jacket, a reason he put on a sweater, a reason he put on sneakers. At this minute, I'm going to spend next half hour with you nonstop. It's me as a director to make it feel like it was no break. It was, and then I'll see you next time, and away he goes. And it's, you know, for kids who have, you know, abandonment issues or you know, to see that, it just works. And it's on television. Give me a break. I mean, it's glass, it's electronics, and that stuff works. And that, I think it's worth cheering about that. You got to be a magician, you know. All of you working in your various technologies, you are accommodating the media to do what you need to do. So it's a partner with you. All the bells and whistles. And
oh yeah,
I think it's marvelous. So
absolutely.
Absolutely. So I'm curious, are there any episodes that you wrote or directed that stick out as some of your favorites?
Sure. The swimming pool one where they dig a pool in a neighborhood of make-believe. Mm-hmm. That was dealt with the economics. We had did a thing for the Department of Labor or something. Like they gave us some money for it. But it's to teach children money, you know, exchange of, you know, give and take and that kind of thing. So if you think about a four-year-old, how you teach, you know, or a three-year-old, what do you do? And digging a swimming pool was the whole thing in the neighborhood to make believe, and they run out of money. They have enough money to dig it, not enough money to finish it because the pipes break, fills up water. So they get the pipes fixed, return everything to normal. So that's the premise of Southwood. Neighbors come in and help. But the challenge there was to say what symbolic things, because children have a bullshit alarm that never goes off. That's what Hemingway said. Human beings have a built-in shockproof bullshit alarm. Okay, so we know when some this is bullshit, you know. And children especially, you can't say, you know, money is a fun, you know, you just, fuck no. You can't do that.
No.
So I remember talking, researched it with Dr. McFarlane, Fred's advisor. And she said, well, you know, she's like this, she's like Buddha or something. You have to listen to her kind of sideways because she was so brilliant and read between the lines. She said, you know, with supply and demand, you know, if you think about it, it has to do with potty training. And I'm listening, saying, all right, let's do this. She said, you know, a child is there with the parent. And the parent says, you have it and I want it. Meaning I'm trying to train you to pee in the toilet. You have it, I want it. And that sense of give and take And then I thought water, and because water is like a big symbol thing. So I said, what if they're built, you know, so I, and it took from there. I started from the neighborhood make-believe and worked my way out. So we went to the treasury, we showed children how people make 25-cent pieces. We went down to the National Mint, I think in Washington, D.C. We went to, you know, his visits had to do with other elements. But the storyline, the thread in Neighborhood Make-Believe was that building a pool, run out of money, people help, back to normal, and they've contained the water that was spraying everywhere. And I had to make it look like Studio A had the big-ass hole, you know, in the ground. So I worked with our art director, Jack Guest, and he figured this thing out. It looked so real. And like a miniature castle at the top, and these people are down with this dirt everywhere. And we would punch up the feed while we're taping into the WQD offices. People just have it on the screen. And one of the program director came running down. He was like, holy shit. What? I still remember he came into the studio. He totally had bought it. He knew it was impossible. But what he saw was a big pit dug in Studio A, filling with water. It was just a great effect. So I have a fond memory of that series of shows. So,
nice.
And it was the whole week. I read to write, for the whole week. So
nice.
Yeah. There are lots of wonderful episodes throughout the series. It's so great. So now even though we kind of talked a little bit of that part a bit earlier, but of course, Mr. Watcher's Neighborhood kind of dealt with a lot of serious topics. Are there any any topics that the show dealt with that you're most fond of?
And I am, let me think of, I'm like, let's see. Music, I suppose. I have a brother. Had a brother who was an opera singer. Another brother, Edward, was an actor in New York. So the fine arts always attracted me. And music, not that I can play trombone and stuff, but music was a great one. Because Wynton Marsalis came by, Yo-Yo Ma, all these. And music is such an important part of our lives. And Fred, it was like everything, It was his chance. he really went mad about it. It was a great series of shows. Yo-Yo Ma in the studio, he was in Joe Negri's music shop, and then Frankenstein visits, and Yo-Yo plays as a cello, very famous cellist. When it was done, I was talking with him, and just he was still sitting there with the cello. We'd watch the playback. It was okay. And he just looked at me and said, you want to lift it up? And it's like a Stradivarius. Yeah. It's like about $1.7 million. And he said, be careful when you lift it up. I said, are you, he said, I don't mean be careful. I mean, just lift it. You're going to be very surprised. And I reached in and I lifted and it went up like a violin. It was so light in my hand. I'm waiting to, grunt up a cello. And he kind of reared back and I put it back down. And it might have been a Stradivarius. He has one. That he said, a Stradivarius, the guy who made it, he knew enough. He knew how much wood to cut away until it stopped, just until it stopped being a cello. A great way of explaining it. But that tension, and I still remember that. To hold something that was, built, made in the 18th century. So music was a big one. And with Fred and people singing and everything, music part of our life.
Piano and wrote all music, all script,
the
whole series.
Johnny Costa, big part of the show for many years.
Yeah,
there are lots of great episodes. Like when it comes to involving with those type of topics, with people, because I know. There are episodes, that Fred talked to, in the camera about death, even.
Yeah.
It's how, people be, yeah. sad and all, but like, you know, like they, you know, he just wants to, no matter what, always think of such happy memories that you all, you know.
Well, like, yeah. And just... look, you know, life is a full range of emotions. And Fred was very concerned about, certainly the effect of a family and children and really just feelings, you know, that feelings are okay to have. They come and they go.
Yeah. Like kind of like,
yeah.
And I mean, that's what I think. Well, you see, I'm watching you react to that in memory. And that's exactly what he was about. And he was no different than you or me. You know, we are all out of the same mold. And that was his congregation, was young children. And nobody had really done that before. But that's all Fred knew to do, just like it's all I knew to do. I don't know what.
He just wants to kind of give it a try and see if that, you know, if that works. Or
yeah.
mm-hmm.
And there were times where one time, you know, he was like, one time there was a guest on that you know, series who was a actress who played Wicked Witch of
West.
Margaret Hamilton. West.
Yeah. Where, you know, because their kids, even adults, even they're like so like scared about, you know, that. But Fred,
you bet.
He just wants to, you know, like, hey, it's just, you know, it's not real. It's just a pretend, you know. And then they want to talk about all the motions of the songs. And like, you know.
Of course. He wrote it.
Like, what do you do with the mad that you feel?
The mad that
you
feel.
Yeah, that's a classic.
Yeah. And you never go down the drain. That's when he sang that by the toilet. Yeah. Mm-hmm. After we did a thing on how people make toilets. You know, ceramic and this. I forget that. I think it was Train Company. Then we went back and he just sing it. Because a child looks at it and says, Jesus, there goes the water. But Fred said, you never can get around a drain. You just can't. I mean, that's pretty awesome. But here's at the root of that, if four words, if it's mentionable, it's manageable. Okay? But if you don't mention it, you can't blah, 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 blah. Tell that to the Ukraine and Putin and whatever. If it's mentionable, it's manageable.
Manageable.
Mm-hmm. You get it out. You know, it's just what it is. But Fred was great at mentioning things that just you never would have thought of. He was just, you know, he's wired into that. That man was born to do it, and he did it.
Oh yeah, and did it well. Songs,
yeah,
very well.
You've got to do it. Dun, dun, dun. Every little thing you got to do it. Do it. Do it. And when you're through, you can dun, 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 you can say you did it. You did it. You. Did it, that stuff, just, and Bobby Vaughn shooting on the camera two, Bobby just moving in on that beautiful shot of his. He was so gifted, a fabulous cameraman. I'd watch Bobby during rehearsal. I'd stay out on the floor and watch Frank come in and open, you know, the open of the show. And I'd watch Bobby moving that big ass camera and pedestaling up and zooming all in this wonderful move as Fred's coming in the door, down the steps, around the corner, and then he sits, and then he stands up. He goes over to pick his jacket up, 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 puts his sweater on. Watching Bobby adjust, it was just like a miracle. And Bob was doing just instinct, you know. He'd done it so often. I love that guy.
That's wonderful.
He made me look good, made us look good. That kind of devotion was great.
So. Yeah. And one time that Big Bird.
When Big Bird was on. Yeah.
I wasn't there for that, but yeah.
Yeah, I also want to make sure that like if you were there or not, because that was such a wonderful, you know.
That was just before, I think.
That was, I think, with maybe before Hume. Yeah, Carol Spinney was the puppeteer. He just died, I think, just a couple of years ago. Or this year or something.
Yeah.
Carol was
rest his soul.
Yes.
And we did, and Fred did a cameo for Sesame Street, too.
Right. Yes.
Yes.
But that was sort of, I was still in Children's Television International, that company, when they were doing that. And I remember before then, I was air director on weekends at WT in Washington, just sitting there watching shows. And I'm there by myself, you know, and I'm just looking at Fred going, give me a break. It's before I had kids, before any of that. I just thought, this is like ridiculous. But, you know, I could not, I had no connection with this guy. Guess what? Who directs for him, writes, is like an apostle, you know, Jesus, me. But I didn't know that. Everybody I knew, unless you have a vested interest, you know, it's okay. So, but I didn't. I will say this, okay? And this is the truth. I know it's suitable. I had to support my family. I knew that. I'm bidding on commercials in town. This is back in the late 70s. The company I was in folded. I'm out just picking up work wherever I can. I answered that ad for broadcasting, wanted, da-da-da. And I also had met that, I think a day before, down in Washington, D.C., in the Blue Mirror Grill, talking with these two guys who wanted to do a movie called The Senator's Wife. Okay? And it was a porn movie. This is like 1979. And it was a 35 millimeter. We had a very good discussion. And I thought, okay, and I'm thinking the next day, then Fred offers, you know, at a certain point, nobody offered me the real job that was in limbo. And I thought, which way is this going to go? Because if it's the senator's wife, it'll be the best movie ever. It'll be the best porn. I don't care. I'm indifferent because I got to support a family and, you know, it's the universe. Or it's Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Ain't that something? And the call comes, and I, with some relief, I take the job with Mr. Rogers, and I tell the guys, thanks, but something else came up. And I had to wait about a year before I told Fred that story. And he loved it when, you know, I told him just what I'm telling you now. I said, Fred, I didn't care. He said, I know. I said, it didn't matter. I said, I know. It had been the senator's wife or me. And I said, I know, man. But, and that's, I think it's, and I'm telling you that as a sense of determination to use whatever talents I have or whatever the hell I had in me to stay alive in the world, contribute where I could, and also to sort of trust, just, you know, I'd gotten through being in the military and during Vietnam, and I'd gotten through all that. And I was still pumping, man. So I'm very glad that I didn't have to do that movie, because I don't know, it was just a stupid script. But anyhow, I didn't write it, man, and I didn't direct it, and I don't even know if it ever got made. I ought to look that up and see if it's. I don't even know where you look, but hey, it's too long ago.
Anyway. I mean, it should be on YouTube or archive.org or if, something like that.
If it got made, even.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly. It'll say not directed by Paul Lally. So.
Yeah.
Too funny.
Exactly. Since you're kind of like mentioned like a kind of couple of songs, like if you're like wondering like any songs that we absolutely loved, you know, that Fred and you got to sing over throughout the whole program, like some of them that I just love, that I feel like his was so stick out that they'll, you know, they're adults now. Like, remember, you know, like for example, like, you know, I'm proud of you.
I'm proud of you.
It's your like, you're a special, and of course, you know, such a good feeling. There's so many, like, of course, it was great, you know, songs, but there is a reason why he wants to. He wants to create those songs, you know. You know, he wants to know the children. You know, what those songs about, and then you know what he did create. I think.
What do you think he was doing? Why? What do you think drove him to sing them? I get to ask you. I mean, we all have a reason. What do you think it might have been? I'm being Fred now. Sorry, but that's what he'd do. He go, well, why don't you tell me? Yeah, I saw him do it all the time. Yeah. Well, what do you think? I mean, what?
He wants to talk with that person.
Yeah, probably just his connection to kids overall, and just that he knows what what will resonate with kids and what works for
exactly.
kids.
And so. You think that's why, yeah, something that, did he do it just for children or for, who do you think he did that for?
I think.
Probably for both kids and adults.
Yeah.
I feel like he probably, I feel like he might have did it for everyone, but with kids in mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
Yeah, because, you know, there are adults out there, you know, still thinking about Mr. Rogers, and you know, like us,
I know.
Of course, you know, and so yeah, you know, it's, you know, has the kind of a huge reminder,
yeah.
even just listening to them again, you know.
Yeah, he's an icon. He is like you know, he's part of the American cultural experience. Is Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood
and the future of children's entertainment? Yep.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. I'm reminded of when Fred Rogers spoke at the Senate. This was back in 1969.
And, yeah, well,
you know, for funding for children's television.
Yep.
And yeah. he had referenced one of the songs he had wrote, What Do You Do With the Mad That You Feel?
When you feel so mad, good bite. That's right.
Bite. Yeah, he's certainly an icon in not only children's television, but a whole bunch of things as well. He also spoke
so
at a lot.
You were
mentioning college students earlier. He spoke at a lot of commencement ceremonies throughout the years. He resonated with so many people.
That's wonderful.
He had a quilt made of all the doctoral ribbons he had. You know, you get the doctoral thing. And it was a patchwork quilt of all these different colleges giving him an honorary doctorate. And you're right. He was a very courageous. He weighed like, what does he weigh? 147 pounds.
143.
143.
143, which he means. 140.
I love you.
I love you. Yeah.
Yes.
Every time I saw that number, he'll give a smile because he's a means I love you, and that's, you know.
Yeah. When
that's
I,
how he is.
When I first got there, my first day there. I drove in from suburban Washington, D.C. I didn't even know where Pittsburgh, I'd flown to Pittsburgh, but I'd never even been there. Christ, I said, this is like the end of the universe. All the way into Western Pennsylvania. So when I get there about 11 o'clock, and my wife, Connie, at the time, my late wife, Connie, and the kids were still back home, and they were trying to figure out we're going to sell the house and move. But I get there, go in, say, hi, Fred. He said, I'm going swimming. You want to come? I said, okay. I have been a lifeguard in my life. You know, I swim. So we went down to the Pittsburgh Athletic Club. And at the time, it was all male. It's in the late, 70s. No females. It's very common for a men's club like that. So there's a swimming pool. And you would swim, as I learned, and I should have known better, in the locker room, in the nude. Okay? Because it's like the Greeks, you know, gentlemen. So I'm in there getting undressed and like, Fred just does it every day, swimming. And I'm walking out to the end of the pool, looking straight up, mind you. I'm not looking at Fred Rogers' pee-pee to tell you. I'm looking straight ahead. And I'm naked. He's naked. And he dives in, starts swimming laps. And I remember just diving in, thinking, here I go, world. I'm just fucking diving in. You know, I'm going to start. So we swam back and forth. Got out, da-da-da-da-da. But... swimming,
man.
In the nude. Now, they don't do it anymore, but that was very common, you know, in the 20s and 30s. The YMCA was that way. I think it was the guys wanted to look at young boys. It's a very Greek thing, you know, the young male, the pre-adolescent male kind of thing. So there's that. But that's, you know, Greek history, not this. But I remember as a little kid, YMCA, a little poor kid, came from a very poor background. You know, they said all the kids had to swim naked because there's chlorine in a pool or something. But my little, remember what I said about a built-in shockproof bullshit alarm? Something told me it's not the damn chlorine, but what the hell? I'm just a little fat kid, you know, what the hell? But Fred and I, we were adults. So we filmed that and later, not that, excuse me. We filmed a sequence where he does go swimming and he always weighs himself when he gets out of the pool and does that. But the sequence we filmed was Fred was wearing a bathing suit, I'm sure, and you may have seen him. We filmed underwater, it was very dramatic. Yeah. had underwater housing on a camera. So a lot of memories and a lot of just, I learned how to be around people who were very talented and well-known and gifted and popular, and to be just normal with them and to try to find that part of them that is as normal as you and me, okay? And just do that, because otherwise I get impressed like anybody. You know, you see somebody out of context, it's something. So I learned with Fred to deal with high profile people, and I have been that way ever since. And I can tell that they're, it's like water to a thirsty plant when you do that, because that's all they want, you know.
Right.
That's all they want. They just want to be treated, you know. Taylor Swift, I'm sure, would love you if you just, what's going on? You know?
Yeah.
She just relax, okay? None of this, you know, godlike stuff, all these things. I think she's terrific, all these talented people, but right. I learned how to do that.
So. Definitely. So while we're on the subject of Fred, you became very close with him, as we have discussed. What was knowing and working with Fred like, just in general as a whole?
Mm-hmm. He was as real as you or me, as easy to get along with. You know, that's where I learned how to treat, you know, just like a regular guy. Terrifically funny. He was a strict vegetarian. He owned a Vegetarian Times. His rule was he didn't want to eat anything that had a mother. I mean, God, that's hard to, okay. Didn't want to eat it, but he didn't. He was a vegetarian, but very cool about it. And he loved to eat them. I loved to eat. So when we would go on filming on location with the crew, we would be gone for a couple of days, go into a restaurant, sit down, and it'd be like five people, cameraman, gaffer, assistant producer, producer me. And you look at the menu, you start talking about what they have. And Fred would say, my, that, look at that big squash, looks very interesting. So sort of that's the cue. Somebody's got to order the big squash, okay? So, but 3 minutes later, everybody knows what we're getting, but they have all of Fred's suggestions are planted in the meal. So by the time the dinner comes, everything kind of comes in a big, you know, everybody takes a little bit of something. So that's how Fred did. And he loved to eat. He knew the value of food. And this is so odd, I'm going to tell you this stuff. But I learned from Fred how to do a close-up of a person, that there's only two people ever who you see like this. Okay? One is your mom, if you're lucky, and the other one is your lover. Okay, and that's it. This is about right. Okay? This is kind of getting close. But Fred would be pretty much a chest shot, okay? And when he would sing a song, and I knew the important part was coming, and Bobby Vaughn on camera too, does this little teeny creep in. See, I'm just creeping in, and he's singing. And dun, 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 but it never gets here, beyond. He said it's the mother's face at the breast. I remember saying that. If you look up as a little baby and your mom was nursing you, you would see this. I mean, it's, give me a break. I mean, that guy, he was tuned in to the very reality that's in all of us. So, and yet he's a funny guy. You know, he drove like a nut. He understood his role in life, and he didn't take himself ever seriously. You know, just like none of us, we don't. We know who we are. And, but he was very courageous when you mentioned his testimony before the Senate, that he basically saved public television that day. Because I forget the chairman, he was a Rhode Island senator who said, I think you just saved your elevator.
He said you just saved the $20 million.
Yeah.
That was a lot of money back then.
That's right.
I can't remember the name at the moment, but yeah, I mean, it was $20 million. You gotta remember, folks, that's a lot of money back in 1969.
Exactly.
And so that was huge for public television.
He was fearless. He was a fearless guy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and at 143 pounds and skinny, narrow-shouldered, soft-spoken, but just like this relentless, you know, he couldn't help himself. And that kind of, well, it's irresistible. And it's daring, you know, to be vulnerable like that. Come on. It's,
yeah,
you know, we all walk, it's very, the tendency is to protect yourself, you know, keeping, you know, keeping up shields and stuff. But we all recognize this, you know, being vulnerable, how powerful that is.
Yeah.
He was a master at it. And I hope that I'm answering your thing about how he was.
Mm-hmm.
But he yeah. was, you know, talk. You could talk with him like you talk with me.
Yeah.
But somewhere in his head, he knows how important that is. So he's not going to bullshit you. He's not going to soft pedal it. He's just going to be honest with you. And
yeah, he he wants to do that to everyone. No matter what it is, no matter what he sees, he wants to be that, just that.
He would always find the very thing you're most proud of. I saw too many newspaper reporters and magazine articles. The show with Tom Hanks that did
Beaufort Dean in the Neighborhood. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's based on
love that movie, by the way.
It's based on a writer from Esquire magazine who did an interview with Fred. I know this guy. He went in expecting Oprah. I'm going to do this puff piece on Fred. And more than once, I was in situations where an interviewer would start talking with Fred. And within about a minute, he'd turn the conversation around. And Fred would say, well, when you were little, did you always want to be a reporter or whatever? And he would begin. And he would just... pretty soon, blah, blah, blah. And you can see these people, both men and women, realizing they can't help talking about themselves because Fred's interested in them. But they also know that time is money and they're there to do an interview with Fred. But he's interested in them. So,
yeah.
And and that the Tom Hanks film was based on that story, basically, that he did that. And, and plus, I thought it was very good. I liked it a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Because
It wasn't all about Fred. It was, and thank God.
It was about one of his friends, Lloyd.
Yeah. And it was about the Esquire writer who had family problems and just whatever. And that was pretty neat. Yeah, I liked that. I liked the documentary I saw, too. Pretty good shot at him. And it's proof of that. If you're interested in it, we're talking about it this afternoon. Fred's been gone, I don't know, how long? 10 years? More? 20?
Longer than that. 21 years.
Yeah.
There you go. There you go. Well, it's a testament, I think, to the human heart and our acknowledging someone who knew how to touch it and touch it well. When we were little, we didn't come out of the womb full blown, man. We were like little pumpkins. We were the ones getting thrown in the air, you know, and hopefully not getting dropped. I didn't drop any of my kids, thank God. But
that,
you know, but it's all in us. And Fred was able to go all the way down, come all the way back up, and really be a staunch defender of childhood. And it worked, I think. He touched many, many lives, still does, man. I'm glad to have been in there doing it, helping him.
Absolutely. I mean, what he did, you know.
Yeah, it's just wonderful.
Yeah. He always, you know, no one can be like him, you know. Yeah.
Yes. So,
just a sweet man, always, you know, with his soul and everything. So.
Yeah. And he could do it because he looked in the lens. He knew how to do it. And remember, though, he was not looking in the lens like I am, the way I told you and all that sort of the methodology. That is, an evil person can do that. But that's where you have to trust your Hemingway, your bullshit alarm, because that'll tell you. But Fred was natural. It's just what he did. And same with Marianne Esposito. She just loves doing what she does. And plus she loves, once we roll tape, we don't stop. So she's in charge. The minute, you know, we point to her, we've planned out the show and I figured it all out, but she just goes. And it's pretty much, I don't have to edit it, you know, it's to time within reason. Yeah.
Yeah, so
exactly.
Moving on from Mr. Rogers, you also wrote two screenplays for Disney. Can you talk a bit about the ones that you wrote?
Oh, yeah, I did one called, Red Riding Hood, that they produced. This was very early on. I think it was before. I don't know if it was. It had to be before I started with Mr. Rogers. It all happened all sort of at once. Yeah, I wrote it for my daughter's 9-year-old, Sarah, at the time. Girls go through what's called a false adolescence at 9, and then they kind of go to sleep. There's a certain vague sexuality that emerges, but it's all fantasy, like princes kissing them, you know, just very that kind of thing. Then it goes to sleep and then back up. That's a lot of fairy tale research that I did with Bruno Bettelheim. So I did Red Riding Hood, which they produced. Disney, I don't know where they do it, but they produced that. I wrote one, Hansel and Gretel, as well. And that was, I don't know if you know, Maurice Sendak was a illustrator. He was all wild about wanting to do that. And it was with many things, you know, it didn't work out. But I got paid for it, so to speak, and I got to write it, you know. And I had those two screenplays. And I was doing that mostly because, you know, the other company was sort of in between jobs. And I don't know, I was just doing it. But I remember doing it for Sarah. Here's why. Because at night I come up, and by then I was doing the fairy tale series for kids, or I would play the audio tapes that I did, and they go to sleep at night. And Sarah and Gaby in the same room, and I would kiss goodnight to Gaby and turn on the cassette. Then I go over and kiss Sarah goodnight and see you in the morning. But I remember one night I bent over to kiss her, and Sarah's like, and I looked in her face and I said, "That's what a little kid looks like. Just before the prince wakes her up in, you know, that's like a prince kiss, waiting for the kiss. It's not me." She's just, there was just something that turned to her cheek. And I remember that was a seed in my head. So when I got in this whole thing about fairy tales and I wrote a screenplay, I did one that has, you know, the research, I don't want to get too much into it, but the hunter and the wolf is the same person. It's a male. It's differentiated, you know, that kind of stuff. And it's just, but it's a great, you know, they bought it. Then they said, "We'll pay you more money if we produce it," which they produced. And I was thrilled. And I think right around then I think Mr. Rogers happened. So it was like, whoa, get a load of me. You know, like I thought I was hot stuff, but, you know, not really, but I was going from, you know, having no money to something. I didn't save the copy of the Mickey Mouse check. I didn't, you know, I should have, because there's Mickey, you know, and the page. It was really neat, but that was a thrill. Those two things. And by then they did another fairy tale series on another cable thing, and their project sort of faded back. So they had movie stars doing stuff. It was a different concept, but not Disney. So. But I did it. So. Little old me, you know, this kid in Woodbridge, Virginia, you know, this schmuck. And this was, I'm just a schmuck, and it worked, and I'm grateful, you know. But I've always this way. Listen, I'm the last one in my family. Everybody else is kind of gone, my brothers and sister. But my brother Ed, who is a theater actor in New York, when I was 4 and he was 6. And I was in the sandbox. And I'd always say, "Come on in, man. Come on." And I got all these trucks going on. He said, "Oh, Jesus." You know, he didn't want to do it. He wanted to go climb a tree, go be active, very athletic. And I'm down in the sandbox saying, "Oh, no, they're going to the cliff. And what's going to happen?" You know, I'm getting all invested in the sandbox. Okay. So now I do, and I've asked people to get in the sandbox with me for many, many years. Come on in. Whether it's novels that I'm writing or whether it was screenplays I was writing, come on in. Let me just, what if? And I just love to do it. That's just how I'm wired. But think of it that way. When I was 4 years old, a little boy, my dad had died in a terrible accident and leaving a family out of luck. And there I was, just playing in the sandbox, but being dead serious. And I'll leave you with this one thought that I think it's Kierkegaard or one of the philosophers might say that the sense of when a person's drowning or alone in the ocean, water everywhere, and they spot the ship is sunk and they spot a piece of wood out in the distance. And the look in their eye when they're going for that wood, that look and that intention is everything. And I have done that my whole life, that, you know, that look, I've had that look in my eye. I'm being fun and laughing and jacking around, but I saw that wood and I went for it, you know, and I just love that thought, that look in my, brother Ed, kind of, he and I talked about that a lot, just in a life of the fine arts and just trying to make it happen, that the passion for it and the wanting it and the needing it, because I didn't want to dig ditches and plumbing because I wasn't that very good at it. So that's my tip. That's my philosophical tending. And I hope you've got enough meat on the bone to do this. Is that okay?
Yes, and since we're kind of getting to the last three questions here, I know we've talked about it a bunch throughout this interview, but now, you know, years after, you know, Mr. Rogers was off the air, and now you're working on this other show, Ciao Italia, as an executive producer. Of course, which you mentioned, you know, working with Marianne Esposito. Overall, what's getting to work with her like on
the same show? As Fred? It's a, she cooks food, and Fred would reach out to children. They're both identical kind of people, both passionate about what they do, and a little bit easier to work with Marianne because I learned at the foot of Fred Rogers. And when I first went to work for her, I remember driving to her house. I'd seen the couple shows she did locally. It was just dreadful. I said, oh my God, I had all these notes thinking, what am I going to do? This is terrible. Not her, it was just the production. It's just stupid. And I got in there, I met her and sat down in her living room. We sat down and talked. And just for my mouth, I had this memory. Mm-hmm. And I said, Marianne, after you film a segment, where do you sit in the studio with the crew and where do you watch playback? Because I'd be interested to know, because when I work with Fred, I remember saying Fred, like Fred and I were drinking butters. When I work with Fred, we'd always look, watch it, you know, playback together, the crew. And then if he liked it, then we would move on. If he didn't, well, we would just do it again. So what about you? Where do you do it? And here comes the world's longest 5 seconds of silence. He went,
oh, wow.
Playback? And I went, got it. So I mentally threw away all the notes I had about why this show was so stupid and awful. Because she had no control. She was just in it. I said, oh, okay, never. Well, if it's all right with you, we're going to do that. Because Fred and I, we felt it very useful. So is that all right with you? And in that moment, I'm mostly throwing the baby in the air, you know, and I'm giving her the keys to the car, whatever the analogy is. Say it's yours. The minute she owned that, did it, I figured it would take like maybe a couple seasons for her to get in the groove. It took her like two shows, and we rehearsed those. We didn't even air those. I taped them. We looked at playback. Dun, 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 dun. She's sitting there watching herself, you know, on the monitor. I should have sent you a photo of that, because we have it even to this day. The two of us sitting there nowadays just watching playback. And of course, it's always good. I don't think we've ever redone one, because nobody drops a baby with Ciao Italia. We don't do it till we're ready, but when we're ready, we do it. But that's what it's like to work with Marianne. Sorry to do I'm Mr. Anecdote today. I can't help it.
So. No, that's okay. That's totally fine.
Perfectly fine.
No worries at all.
Anything else there, Chris? Or Jake, what's up?
So since we're about to like what Chris said, about to get close to wrapping up. So I'm kind of curious, can you share any projects you're currently working on?
My writing mostly. We're still trying to get funding for a new season of Chow, but I'm in my third novel and first draft of Flyboy. So that's nice. What I get up at 2 in the morning, 2:30, I write every morning, make breakfast for my wife who leaves for work, and I take off my writer's hat and I go to other stuff during the day, but I get up in the morning and write. So
nice.
13 novels later, and yeah, so that's what I'm working on. And I'm helping trying to get funding because public television, you know, for Chow.
Nice.
I have put all the shows ever that we've ever produced. I've gone in, stripped out all the underwriting and all the kind of stuff, where it's content only. So think of it as Marianne's life work. You know, Fred Rogers, you really can't have access to anything he ever did. You have to kind of sort your way through. But Marianne, Chow Italia will have its own. We have a very good website, but all the full episodes will be one of these days available that we ever did. You just go in and look at them, you know.
Nice.
That's my gift to her, because Fred didn't get that, and I was determined to do that. So for the past 3 years, I've been going through the shows, you know, editing, trimming, and that's technology. I could do it in Arizona, so it's okay. So
nice.
Do that.
Yeah.
And I cook and take care of the cats, feed chickens. You know, it's what I do.
That's great. Can I wait for more novels?
Oh, yeah. Well, to go to paul-lally.com or Amazon. And just put in Amazon. I do Kindle publishing. Did some I did independently publish. So it's great. And
nice.
I like it.
So the last question that Matt's about to ask, a question we ask all of our guests at the end. Go ahead, Matt.
Thank you, Chris. If you folks didn't catch it the first time, at the very beginning, this podcast is called Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show. When you think of nostalgia, what do you think of? Or in your own words, how do you define the word nostalgia?
Is that your lead in line? What were you doing?
You're asking me.
Yes.
Oh my God. You could trim that. It sounded very much like. And stay tuned. Yeah. What do I find nostalgic? Jesus, that's very funny. Well, that's your answer. Professional Paul Lally completely drops the ball. That's great. What's nostalgic for me?
How do you define the word nostalgia? Pretty much.
It's very funny. Well, I mean, what's nostalgic for me? Talking with you, Ophemi, it's the best. I get to look back at things that won my heart, and they come alive again.
Nice. Great word send on.
It's wonderful.
Yes. Well, Paul, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. This was a blast.
My pleasure. It's good to see you guys. I wish you the very best.
You too.
And I love you. I love
you
just the way you are. There's nobody in the world exactly like you. Okay.
Yes, and DJ Bob Brunkle, he says hello.
Oh yeah.
Bob, great friend of ours.
Very good friend.
Yes, good.
He's wonderful. Thank you so much for what you've done over the years, and you know, especially in the way of involvement in Mr. Rogers' neighborhood and a lot of things that you've done over the years, and keep up a great work and what you're doing now. Can I wait what's next in store for you? And
thank you.
It means a lot.
I wish it straight back at you.
I'm gonna go call
my wife now and feed the chickens, okay?
Yes. All right, keep in touch, Paul. Let you know when this goes up.
Oh, thank you. Okay, I love you and see you.
You too. See you soon, Paul.
You too, Paul. Take care. Thanks again.
Bye.
Bye.
There should be like a red There you go. Well, it's goodbye from us as well, everybody. We absolutely enjoyed our time speaking with Paul Lally. Links to his website and his social media will be in the description down below for anyone who wants to connect with him or check out his work.
Yep. And check out, if you want to check out his books, that's already published or it's going to be coming out. It's also the Amazon links will be in the description down below. So any of y'all want to get a copy.
Or check out his website as well, paullally.com. Make sure you include the line there between the first and last name, paullally.com.
Yes. But keep on the lookout for more wonderful interviews coming your way. And as always, what do we say, Jake?
Keen Nostalgia Live. Take care, everyone. See you next time. Take care. Bye.
Don't drop the baby either. Bye.
Yes.
Bye.
Take care.
Thank you for tuning in to another wonderful Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show interview. Be sure to follow Jake and the crew on social media and stream the show wherever you find your favorite podcasts. And as always, remember to keep nostalgia alive. Bye-bye.